A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
We have a special prompt today from Ollie in Manchester. Ollie describes growing up in a household where shame was a major emotional currency. Recently, his mother helped him out with some money and told him he shouldn't feel ashamed to be receiving it. An unexpected remark, though he notes she's a profoundly disturbed personality. He's a renter in his 40s, and his mother also recently remarked that there's a major shame associated with renting at this age. He says he hadn't really felt that before, but now he does. His question is, am I an embarrassment or a failure? And more broadly, how do personalities create this? And what can one do to dislodge the hold that this powerful negative emotion can have on one?
That's a remarkably precise description of a shame loop being installed in real time. The mother hands over money and says, "Don't be ashamed." Which is already a strange thing to say, because it presupposes shame should be present, and then separately names renting as shameful. Two contradictory injections in different conversations. One says receiving help carries potential shame. The other says your housing situation is shameful. Ollie's now scanning his life through a lens she provided.
The thing that jumps out at me is the timeline. He wasn't feeling shame about renting. She named it, and now he feels it. That's not a feeling emerging from genuine self-reflection. That's a feeling being handed to him like a package he didn't order. It's like someone walking up to you on the street and saying, "That jacket you're wearing, you should be embarrassed to own it," and suddenly you are, even though you've worn it happily for years.
And that's where the distinction between shame and guilt becomes essential. Guilt is, I did something bad, it's behavior-focused, and it can actually motivate repair. You feel guilty about snapping at someone, you apologize, the feeling resolves. Shame is, I am bad, it's identity-focused. Brené Brown's research has shown pretty conclusively that shame correlates with addiction, depression, and aggression, while guilt correlates with positive behavioral change. They're not just different feelings, they have different outcomes.
Guilt points at an action you can fix. Shame points at you, full stop. And that's why guilt can be useful, but shame almost never is.
And when shame gets installed early by a parent, it doesn't stay attached to specific incidents. It becomes what psychologist John Bradshaw called toxic shame, shame that's been internalized as a permanent identity feature. It's not, I made a mistake, it's, I am a mistake. Ollie's mother didn't just comment on renting, she activated a circuit that was probably laid down decades ago. The renting comment was just the key turning in a lock that was already there.
Let's get into the mechanism here, because I think most people experience shame as this diffuse, awful feeling without understanding what's actually happening in the brain. What's the neuroscience?
There's a landmark study from 2003 at UCLA, Naomi Eisenberger and colleagues, that found something striking. Social pain and physical pain share neural circuitry. Shame activates the anterior cingulate cortex and the insula, which are the same regions that light up when you're experiencing physical pain. Shame is literally painful. Your brain processes social rejection and shame the same way it processes a burn or a broken bone.
When Ollie's mother makes that comment about renting, his brain registers it as something closer to an injury than an opinion. It's not a disagreement. It's a wound.
That explains why shame avoidance becomes such a powerful motivator. The brain learns to treat shame triggers as threats, and it starts routing decisions around avoiding that pain. The problem is, the avoidance itself becomes a cage. If you're avoiding shame rather than pursuing goals, you're not making decisions based on what you want. You're making decisions based on what won't hurt.
That's a profound reframe. Most people think they're making choices based on desire or ambition. But what you're saying is that for someone with an installed shame loop, they're actually making choices based on pain avoidance. The primary driver isn't what they want. It's what they're afraid of feeling.
And you can imagine how that distorts a life trajectory over decades. You're not navigating toward a destination. You're navigating away from a threat. every fork in the road is evaluated not by which path leads where I want to go, but by which path is least likely to trigger that burning shame sensation. It's like driving a car where the steering wheel is controlled by what you're trying not to hit, rather than where you're trying to go.
I want to dig into how a parent installs this. What's the actual mechanism in a family system? How does a comment from a parent become a permanent feature of someone's internal landscape?
There's a concept from family systems theory, shame induction. Researchers Sheff and Retzinger studied this directly. When a family member uses shame statements, you should be ashamed, what will people think, I'm embarrassed by you, it produces measurable cortisol spikes in the recipient that persist for hours. It's not just words. It's a physiological stress response being triggered repeatedly.
So a comment at breakfast is still doing biological work at dinner. The body is still marinating in stress hormones long after the conversation ended.
If that's happening throughout childhood, the child's threat detection system gets calibrated around shame. The child learns to pre-feel the shame to avoid the punishment. If I can anticipate what will trigger the parent's shaming response, I can avoid it. That becomes an automatic scanning system running in the background all the time. The child becomes a shame meteorologist, constantly scanning the emotional sky for incoming storms.
Which means Ollie's response to his mother's ranting comment wasn't a new reaction. It was a pre-installed schema being activated. The antenna was already up. She just broadcast on a frequency it was already tuned to receive.
The schema was there waiting. She just gave it new content. And here's the double bind in his specific situation. She told him not to feel ashamed about receiving money and then separately told him renting is shameful. So one message says, shame is something you shouldn't feel, and the other says, here's something to feel ashamed about. He's being told to reject shame and accept it simultaneously. That's a classic double bind, and it makes the recipient wrong either way. If he feels shame, he's failing at her instruction not to. If he doesn't feel shame, he's failing at her standard about renting.
There's no correct response. The game is unwinnable by design.
That's often the point with these dynamics. It's not about the content. It's about maintaining a relationship where the parent holds the power to define reality. The double bind keeps the child perpetually off balance, perpetually seeking approval that can never be consistently earned because the rules keep shifting.
Let's put some numbers on the renting piece, because I think that's important for cutting through the cultural noise. Ollie mentioned that renting is somewhat normalized where he lives, but maybe not at his age. What's the actual picture?
As of 2026, the home ownership rate in the U.S. for 35 to 44-year-olds is 61.2%, down from 69.2% in 2004. That's Census Bureau data. So nearly 40% of people in Ollie's age bracket are renters. He's not an outlier. He's part of a large and growing statistical majority of non-owners in that demographic.
The shame he's being asked to feel is about failing a standard that nearly 40% of his peers also don't meet. If you gathered 100 people his age in a room, 40 of them would be in exactly the same housing situation. It's not a personal failing. It's a demographic reality.
That standard itself is historically contingent. The cultural script that says homeownership equals adulthood is largely a post-World War II construction. It was built on specific economic conditions, GI Bill benefits, federally subsidized mortgages, a booming manufacturing sector that simply don't exist in the same form now. The median home price-to-income ratio has roughly doubled since the 1980s. Expecting someone to hit the same milestone their parents hit at 25 in a radically different economic environment is like expecting someone to run the same race on a track that's been tilted uphill.
That's the thing about installed shame. It often uses standards from a previous era as if they're timeless. The parent bought a house at 25 in 1985, so the child should buy a house at 25 in 2026. The fact that the economics have completely transformed doesn't enter the equation, because the shame isn't about economics. It's about the parent's need to project a standard and the child's failure to meet it. The economics are just the excuse.
That brings us to projection. In families with a parent who has narcissistic or borderline traits, and Ollie described his mother as a profoundly disturbed personality, shame often operates through projection. The parent has their own unprocessed shame, their own sense of inadequacy. They can't tolerate feeling it, so they externalize it onto the child. The child becomes the container for the parent's shame. and the child, as a survival strategy, accepts it. If I hold mom's shame, maybe she'll be okay, and maybe I'll be safe.
That's a heavy thing to carry into your 40s. You're not just dealing with your own feelings about your life. You're carrying someone else's emotional waste that got dumped into you before you were old enough to recognize what was happening.
It doesn't stay contained to one domain. Once the shame loop is running, it generalizes. Ollie says he now finds himself feeling shame when he probably shouldn't, and treating avoiding shame as essential. That's the loop expanding beyond renting, beyond the mother's comments, into a general operating system. It's like a virus that starts in one organ and eventually infects the whole body.
Let's trace that. Once the shame loop is installed and running, what does it actually do to decision-making over time? What are the knock-on effect?
The first major knock-on effect is what I'd call preemptive failure. When avoiding shame becomes the primary motivator, you start ruling out options not because they're bad options, but because they carry any risk of shame exposure. Career moves you don't make because you might fail publicly. Relationships you don't pursue because you might be rejected. Financial decisions you avoid because you might look foolish. The shame loop imposes a hidden tax on life outcomes. You're not optimizing for what you want, you're optimizing for what won't trigger the pain.
The loop doesn't just make you feel bad. It shrinks your life. It's like living in a house where certain rooms are locked because they might contain something painful, and over time you're living in a smaller and smaller space.
That's a perfect analogy. And here's the second effect. It creates a self-fulfilling prophecy of inadequacy. Here's how that cycle works. Ollie feels shame about renting. He interprets that feeling as evidence that he should be ashamed. The feeling itself becomes proof of the judgment. That intensifies the shame, which he then interprets as further evidence. The feeling validates the judgment, and the judgment intensifies the feeling. It's a closed loop that doesn't require any external input to keep running.
The feeling becomes its own evidence. That's insidious. It's like a prosecutor who points to the defendant's nervousness as proof of guilt, and the more nervous the defendant gets, the more guilty they look.
It's one of the most destructive features of shame. Guilt has an off switch. You make amends, the feeling resolves. Shame doesn't have a natural off switch because it's not about something you did. It's about something you believe you are. You can't apologize your way out of being a failure. You can only keep feeling it. The loop runs on its own momentum.
What breaks the loop? If shame doesn't have a natural off switch, what's the intervention? How do you actually stop something that's designed to be self-perpetuating?
Brené Brown's shame resilience framework is the most researched approach here. She identifies four elements. First, recognizing shame triggers, being able to identify what's happening in your body and mind when shame activates. Second, practicing critical awareness, questioning the social and cultural messages that are triggering the shame. Third, reaching out. Shame thrives in secrecy and isolation, so telling someone you trust is a direct countermeasure. Fourth, speaking shame. Naming it out loud reduces its power.
That last one sounds almost too simple. Just saying I feel shame about renting actually does something? It feels like it shouldn't work. It feels like the problem is too big for such a small intervention.
It does, and there's neurobiological backing for why. When you name an emotion, you activate the prefrontal cortex, the part of the brain involved in regulation and reasoning. That activation dampens activity in the amygdala, which is driving the fear and threat response. Researchers at UCLA found that simply labeling an emotion, what they call affect labeling, reduces amygdala activation within about 90 seconds. It's not just therapeutic advice, it's a physiological intervention. You're literally changing your brain chemistry by putting words to the feeling.
The act of naming shame literally changes what your brain is doing with it. It's like turning on a light in the dark room. The darkness doesn't disappear, but you can suddenly see the shapes for what they are instead of what you feared they were.
There's a specific technique from emotion regulation research called cognitive reappraisal that builds on this. A 2023 study from UC Berkeley had participants practice cognitive reappraisal on shame-inducing memories. After 4 weeks, they showed about a 40% reduction in shame intensity. The technique is straightforward. When shame arises, you ask two questions. Is this shame about my behavior or my identity? And is the source of this judgment someone whose values I actually endorse?
That second question feels like the key one for Ollie. Is the source of this judgment someone whose values I endorse? Because if the answer is no, then the whole thing unravels. Why am I letting someone whose values I reject define how I feel about my life?
If the answer is no, if the shame was installed by a parent whose values you don't share, whose judgments you've spent years trying to escape, then labeling the source explicitly reduces the shame's grip. This is my mother's shame, not mine. That's not just a mantra. It's a cognitive reappraisal that, according to the research, measurably reduces the intensity of the shame response. You're not just telling yourself a comforting story. You're engaging in a technique with documented neurological effects.
I want to get practical here. If Ollie is listening, what does he actually do starting today? What's the concrete protocol?
There's an exercise called a shame inventory that's particularly useful for installed shame. You list the domains where you feel shame: renting, income, relationship status, whatever comes up. For each one, you identify three things. Who first taught you this was shameful? Do you actually believe their values? And what would your life look like if you didn't feel shame in this domain?
That last question is powerful because it forces you to imagine an alternative. It externalizes the shame from identity to history. This isn't who I am. This is something that was done to me. It's the difference between I am a shameful person and I was taught to feel shame about certain things by a specific person for specific reasons.
For Ollie's specific renting shame, the inventory would likely reveal something clarifying. The source is a parent who bought a house at 25 in a completely different economic era. The standard he's failing was achievable in 1985. It's not achievable in the same way in 2026 for a large portion of the population. The shame isn't about a real failure. It's about failing a standard that no longer applies. It's like being ashamed you can't buy a house for what your parents paid. The world changed, but the expectation didn't.
The three-step protocol would be: name the shame aloud. I feel shame about renting. Identify the source. My mother installed the script. Ask the reappraisal question: is this standard one I would choose for myself?
The answer to that last question, for Ollie, seems pretty clear. He wasn't feeling shame about renting before she named it. He was fine. The shame isn't his. It's hers, projected onto him, and he's been carrying it. He's been holding someone else's baggage for decades and thinking it was his own.
I think there's something important to say about expectations here. Shame resilience is a skill, not a personality trait. It requires practice, especially when the shame was installed early and repeatedly. You don't do this once and get cured. This isn't a one-and-done intervention.
The shame loop will reactivate. That's not a failure of the intervention. It's the nature of deeply installed patterns. The goal isn't to never feel shame. The goal is to shorten the time between feeling it and recognizing it as installed rather than earned. The first time, it might take days to catch the loop and reappraise. After practice, it might take hours. The loop still fires, but it doesn't run the show. You go from being controlled by it to observing it.
That reframe matters because shame itself will try to use the relapse as evidence. See, you're still feeling shame. You must really be a failure. Recognizing that as the loop talking, not reality, is part of the skill. The shame will try to weaponize the recurrence of shame. That's how sophisticated this thing is.
There's a broader question here that I think Ollie's prompt raises. What happens to a society where shame is increasingly weaponized in families and then amplified by social media? Social media is essentially a shame amplification engine. It provides infinite opportunities for social comparison and public judgment. If you're already carrying installed shame from a toxic family system, social media doesn't just trigger it. It validates it. Look, everyone else is buying houses. Look, everyone else is succeeding. The algorithm serves you evidence that the shame is correct.
We're raising a generation with hyperactive shame loops, and we're building infrastructure that feeds them. It's like we're constructing shame factories and then wondering why everyone feels terrible about themselves.
The renting example is a perfect case study because it's so economically widespread but culturally denied. Nearly 40% of 35 to 44-year-olds rent. That's tens of millions of people. Many of them are carrying some version of this shame, installed by parents who don't understand the economics, amplified by social media comparisons, and never examined because shame's whole mechanism is to prevent examination.
Shame wants to stay hidden. That's its survival strategy. It's like a creature that lives in the dark and dies in the light. The moment you look at it directly, it starts to lose power.
Which is why speaking it is the first and most important intervention. Shame can't survive being named and shared. It's like a fungus that dies in sunlight. The moment Ollie wrote that prompt to us, he was already doing the work. He named it. He shared it. He questioned it. He took the first step without even knowing it was a step.
Let's pull this into three concrete takeaways, because I think Ollie and anyone in a similar situation needs something they can hold on to. Something they can return to when the loop fires again.
First takeaway, shame is not a moral signal. It's an installed threat detection system. You can question its source without questioning your worth. The question isn't, am I a failure? The question is, whose definition of failure am I using? If the definition belongs to someone whose values you don't share, the shame isn't yours. It's a hand-me-down that never fit.
Second takeaway, the shame loop can be interrupted with a simple three-step protocol. Name the shame aloud. Identify the source. Who installed this script? Ask the reappraisal question. Is this standard one I would choose for myself? That sequence, practiced regularly, measurably reduces shame intensity. It's not magic. It's neuroscience.
Third takeaway, shame resilience is a skill you build, not a trait you either have or don't. Expect the loop to reactivate. When it does, that's not evidence that you're a failure. It's evidence that you were trained early and thoroughly. The metric to track isn't whether you feel shame, it's how quickly you recognize it as installed rather than earned. Progress isn't the absence of the feeling. Progress is the shrinking gap between the feeling and the recognition.
Let's end where we started, with Ollie's question. Am I an embarrassment or a failure? I think the question itself is the shame loop speaking. It's presenting a forced choice between two identity-level condemnations, both of which assume the shame is valid. The real question is, whose standards am I using to evaluate my life, and do I endorse them? If the answer is no, if the standards belong to a disturbed personality who installed them for her own reasons, then the question dissolves. You're not an embarrassment or a failure. You're someone who was handed a script you didn't write, and you're now in the process of reading it aloud and realizing it's not yours. And that realization, that the voice in your head saying you're not enough might not even be your voice, that's where the loop starts to break.
If this episode resonated with you, and you've got your own shame loop story, send it in. We may do a follow-up on collective shame patterns. What happens when millions of people are carrying similar installed scripts and starting to compare notes?
Thanks to Ollie for sending in this prompt, and thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The Namib Desert's Welwitschia mirabilis plant produces a specialized polysaccharide gum that chemically resembles the agglutinative structure of a Inuktitut, where a single word can encode what would be an entire sentence in English. The Welwitschia's gum polymerizes multiple sugar units into a single molecule that resists degradation for over 1,000 years.
Right. This has been my Weird Prompts. If you want to send us your own prompt or story, email the show@myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.